in these contexts, of course, with a little bit of technical assistance. So forgive the delay. But first of all, may I thank you, Master President, and all of you here for the great honour of this invitation and the opportunity this evening to share some thoughts with you about the nature of bodies, about language and communication, in the hope that some of what I say may trigger some more serious and better informed discussion than I'm able to bring to the subject from those so well qualified to address the question. Most of the time, we take it for granted that we know what a body is. A body is a system of interaction. A body is a set of material processes. A body is a lump of stuff. And yet, time and again in our experience, there are moments when we realize that bodies are more than this. We realize that in moments, for example, when we understand that some obscure kind of information or connection is passed on by a gesture, a look, a touch. We understand it in some of the mysterious ways in which bodies appear to repair themselves, even when we're not expecting them to. We grasp something of it, of course, in those extreme situations so eloquently set out by Oliver Sacks, where the body seems to retain a memory of its entire self-image, even at times when parts of the body are actually missing. Some of you will remember Oliver Sacks' wonderful book, A Leg to Stand On. We're familiar with the phenomenon of phantom pain in amputated limbs and the like. And within all this, it's not insignificant to remember that the brain itself is a bodily reality. Not a machine tucked away inside our material identity, not simply a set of abstract algorithms, but another lump of stuff, which rather mysteriously processes, organizes, and shares information. And that, it seems to me, is one of the areas where theology, philosophy, and the practice of sciences like medicine intersect and overlap, in that recognition that bodies are more than simply lumps of stuff. Bodies speak. Bodies communicate. Bodies carry around meaning. We've all now become used to the idea that philosophical dualism won't do as an account of the kind of being we are. The ghost in the machine model is something profoundly unpopular, rightly so, with most philosophers. We are not a solid bit and a less solid bit. We are not a lump of bone and fat and hair with some mysterious, elusive, what should we say, spiritual gas operating inside. We're not minds isolated from matter. But exactly what it means to grant that we're not that takes time to work out. But there have been those philosophers who have very helpfully suggested that our very idea of knowledge depends on how our bodies find their way in the world. We develop the very notion of an object in the world by mapping an environment in which we bump into things and have to find our ways around them. If you want to find out about theories of knowledge, find out things that matter about theories of knowledge, it may be more profitable to spend some time watching an 8-month child crawling across the floor than to read a great many philosophical texts. We begin by mapping our environment. What resists? What doesn't resist? How do we internalize and remember the ways around things? How do we internalize and preserve that map that tells us the routes we can follow in order not to bump into things. The great French philosopher of the 20th century, Simone Weil, spends a great deal of attention in her early lectures on philosophy devoted simply to this question of how our knowing begins with that deeply material element. We learn how not to bump into things. We learn, therefore, that we can't be bodies unless other things are. We learn that we are material realities in a world of material realities. We learn through contact. And again, philosophers of the last century were intrigued and challenged by the idea that we could only see ourselves as bodies, as three-dimensional, solid occupiers of a point of view, if we understood other points of view. That very remarkable German philosopher, Edith Stein, who in later life converted to Roman Catholicism, became a Carmelite nun, and died as a martyr in Auschwitz because of her Jewish heritage. Edith Stein, almost exactly 100 years ago, published a brief work on the concept of empathy. Empathy understood not as fellow feeling for other people in misery, which is how we frequently use it now, but empathy as the capacity of human subjects to understand themselves by understanding others. We can only have the notion of a three-dimensional self occupying a point of view if we know that there are other points of view. We literally, physically, cannot be ourselves without others. It's a bold metaphysical claim, and exactly what it amounts to will doubtless be disputed for a long time. But it's certainly a helpful corrective to the idea that all we really need to know about ourselves is obvious. It is, in fact, not particularly obvious what a body is. It's not as if that is given to us in a simple way, whereas our understanding of ourselves as minds is more and unnecessarily complicated. Learning what it is to be a body is indeed something we learn. And all of that, once again, tells against the crude idea that the body is simply a self-contained system, working out its own inner determinisms. The body maps, the body pictures, the body pictures itself by imagining what it isn't. The body locates itself against other bodies. And the information which our bodily systems process are more than simply those little bits of information that we think of in relation to our DNA. They are literally geographical and social bits of information. They are the information we need in order to survive as material beings in a material world. So once again, it's not entirely surprising that scientific research pushes more and more towards a more sophisticated understanding of how that mapping works. Some of you may know the extraordinary and very long work by Ian McGilchrist, The Master and His Emissary, published a few years ago, one of those least read bestsellers, I suspect. If you have a few months to spare and feel like reading 700 pages, which combine neuroscience, metaphysics, and literary criticism with a great deal of cultural history thrown in, feel free. But I can promise you that it's a rewarding experience. McGilchrist has been criticized for some of his conclusions and suggestions, but the very heart of what he's arguing is that the brain is not simply a processor of fragments of information. The brain ambitiously creates large pictures. It connects. And although the two hemispheres of the brain have often been seen almost in a mythological opposition, the virtuous right hemisphere and the vicious left hemisphere, that's, of course, a caricature. Nonetheless, the brain's operations do fall into two roughly distinct categories. That which enables us to solve localized problems, that which enables us to locate those localized problems in a wider field. And we know, of course, from studies of the effects of lesions on the brain, exactly where some of these functions, primarily, though not exclusively, cluster. We know that, very, very broadly speaking, the left hemisphere has more to do with localized problem solving, and very, very roughly, that the right hemisphere has more to do with global connective picturing. What is, of course, even more extraordinary about the brain is the capacity of a brain that has suffered lesions in one or the other area to reinvent functions in other parts of its own physical construction. Once again, suggesting that the way in which information, language is processed within the body is a highly sophisticated and complex business. But McGilchrist's argument is essentially that our awareness of the world around, intrinsically drawing on both of these sets of functions, has become dangerously out of kilter in the civilization of the last couple of centuries. We are more and more fixated on localized problem solving, short-term perspectives, narrow or tunnel vision. We are less and less literate in the synthetic picture that we can put together, less and less able to understand how we put things together. To use a vivid image which recurs in McGilchrist's book from time to time, we are getting better and better at recognizing noses and worse at recognizing faces. What, after all, is a nose but a feature of a face? We understand it as part of a whole. The more we think exclusively about noses, the more we become illiterate and incompetent at recognizing faces. And of course, there are, once again, in the case histories, examples of various kinds of cerebral lesions which leave people with comparable disabilities. Are we making our society dysfunctional by focusing too much on noses rather than faces? One of the things that makes McGilchrist's book so annoying for specialists of all kinds, in literary criticism, in the sciences, and in philosophy, is that he paints with an unashamedly broad brush, rather as I'm doing this afternoon, no doubt with equally annoying effect. But in a way, that's the whole point of his book. By allowing small-scale problem solving to shoulder its way into, as we say these days, pole position, by losing many of the resources we've historically used to keep our sense of connection and wider pictures alive, we are in fact disabling ourselves in all kinds of ways. Somewhere near the heart of it is, I suppose, a modern version of the complaint which C.P. Snow first articulated in my own university about the two cultures. But it's more than that. And to revisit Snow's account of it is, I think, to realize just how not to set up the problem. But the issue is real enough. We have all too easily supposed that the humanities in our intellectual world are about big pictures, and the sciences are about localized problem solving. The localized problem solving is hard knowledge. The big picture is soft knowledge. Science is tough. Humanities are woozy. Most scientists of any stature will have something to say about that, as will a good many philosophers and others on the other side. The point, however, is that we are at risk if we are inhabiting an intellectual culture where what counts as solid or real or defensible knowledge is restricted to what we need to solve problems on the small scale, restricted to what I've been unkindly calling nose knowledge. And that's not a matter of sciences versus humanities. It's a matter of understanding that within both sciences and humanities, several languages may be operating, each at its different level, significant and necessary for a balanced apprehension of our world. I'm struck frequently by the way in which our approach to the teaching of science and mathematics in, for example, secondary education so often and so regrettably buys into the kind of polar oppositions and artificial divisions I've been talking about. As I go about my regular work, I find myself quite often speaking to sixth formers about problems of religion and science. And frequently, what I want to argue with them about is not so much the religion as the science. I have no claim at all to competence in the natural sciences. But I can watch natural scientists at work, and I know that what they do is some distance away from what a good many secondary schools encourage them to think. It seems to me extremely important that if we deepen and broaden the scientific education of our school students at secondary level and indeed at tertiary level, one of the things we will need to go on doing is underlining the role of imagination, the role of the big picture, the role, indeed, of some of those right brain functions mentioned earlier, which operate in successful science. Once again, the point needs to be made. For science to operate successfully in the long term, for materialism, you might say, to work as a way of understanding our world, we need a highly sophisticated doctrine or vision of matter. We need to know that matter itself, so far from being dead stuff, is energy conveying information. We need to know, to go back to where I started, that and how bodies speak. The idea that matter is somehow dead is still one that has a certain amount of traction in popular science. You hear people talking about the silent and sterile expanses of outer space. You'll hear people talking about the heartless and mindless processes of the material world. And that rather, to my ears, rather Edwardian picture of natural science is one which, once again, most practicing scientists would find it rather hard to sign up to. The notion that out there, outside my body and my mind, is a lot of dead stuff, occasionally showing signs of moderate animation, as in a lecturer's audience, let's say, but outside there is just stuff, dies hard. When a philosopher of the excellence and sophistication of Daniel Dennett can say, at the end of the day, it's just stuff, you know you have a philosophical problem to address. Because matter, as the crystallization of processes of energy exchange, matter as constantly receiving and transmitting intelligible pattern, is something very definitely not dead, not static or passive. It's something of a paradox. Modern philosophers and modern scientists have often complained about a long-standing Western philosophical tradition, going back to Plato, in which the spirit is active and matter is dead. And yet that is exactly the world which we're encouraged to return to again and again, rather than the understanding of a world in which matter is itself spirited, to coin a term for that. Matter is itself part of the flow of intelligence and of information. So, as we think about materiality, the material world, it's very important in our present intellectual climate to be constantly puzzled and stretched by that question of what we actually mean by matter. When we reach the further territories of something like string theory, I'm no longer at all sure what I mean or anybody else means by saying that the world is a set of material processes. Certainly, they're not material processes of the kind that some of our 17th century predecessors, to genuflect in the direction of John Locke, thought of. That is, the relation of hard, small objects. A good deal of vastly important scientific advance depended on the assumption that the world must be, in good old Aristotelian style, a system of hard, small objects. Your scientific sophistication enabled you to look for smaller and smaller and smaller hard objects, until the point around 100 years ago when the whole model began to turn itself inside out. In the work of the most serious and creative scientists of the age, in a way which unfortunately has not always been caught up with by some of those who teach and indeed practice science. So part of what I'm arguing this afternoon is a protest against the curious philosophical dualism that still haunts some kinds of science, arguing in favour of a robust, three-dimensional, and possibly even more than that, picture of the material world as speaking, as carrying information, as encoding paths for us in ways which enable us to make sense. Bodies, as soon as we're aware of them, mean something. They are located in relation to other bodies. They are in dialogue with, in conversation with other bodies, long before even speech occurs. Because that contact with other bodies grows and develops the sense of being a body. I become myself, occupying this zero point of orientation, as Edith Stein called it, occupying this zero point of orientation because of being part of the conversation of bodily contact, the discovery of how not to bump into things. I've spoken in other contexts of some of the implications that this might have for our humanity at large. And some of those implications, of course, bear on the work of the physician, at least as much as they do on other areas. In a world like this, a world which is not composed of hard stuff and soft minds, then part of what constitutes an intelligent way of inhabiting such a world is what I like to call attunement. We don't simply come to a passive world out there with a grid to place upon it. We come waiting and attending, looking for ways in which we can reinforce, echo, subtly modify, but only by going within the processes and the exchanges already going on. And for me, one of the most vivid images of this I've ever come across, and I've written a little bit about this elsewhere, is the work of one of my friends who for years has been involved in therapy with young people at the severe end of the autistic spectrum. Her work has consisted very largely in attending to what's going on, watching for and picking up the physical rhythms that an autistic young man, for example, is manifesting. And sometimes those rhythms take a very, very long time to pick up. You may notice, after a long period, that there is a pattern somewhere emerging, even if it's only a pattern of the drumming of a finger on a table or the shaking of a head. Feed that pattern back, and you find something like an exchange begins, something like a response. And having watched some film of my friend in action, I can confirm that over a 24 or 48 hour period, it becomes possible for something new to happen. Bodies have spoken to each other. Rhythms have been picked up. An attunement has occurred that springs somebody out of their isolation. And if I wanted an image of what the speaking body was like, I would think of those exchanges. The therapist's profound, silent, intelligent attention to rhythms and patterns that are emerging. The ability of the therapist to enter into the world, the apparently locked world of the autistic youth, to feed back, to create response, and eventually to guarantee something like a conscious relationship. To see film of one such youngster after 48 hours in Phoebe's company, actually smiling and pushing his face against hers, is moving beyond words. But it is an illustration of what may happen when bodies are seen as intelligent and attended to, attuned to, in that kind of way. All of you will know far better than I how attunement works in therapeutic practice. How unhelpful it is to suppose that there is a ready-made course of action, a grid to be imposed. How crucial it is for anything like transforming healing that the specificity of a person be taken into account. You know this, and I won't labour the point. But to go back to McGilchrist's concerns, what if we are increasingly living in a culture in which the time and the intelligence to learn attunement are becoming less and less available? When the pressures of artificial metrics make it harder and harder to attend to the specific and to understand the non-mechanistic ways in which bodies work. I believe very strongly that that's where some of the history of medicine so dramatically and inspiringly embodied in this building comes into play. I believe this is where it's important to remember how profoundly the medical profession has defined itself again and again as an art as well as a science. Partly because of that deeply ingrained practice of attention and attunement. We all know, of course, and again you'll know better than I, that that may be something of an idealized view of the profession, as it was and as it is. Readers of English fiction will know that the local physician in most 19th century novels is seldom an impressive figure scientifically, however attractive he, and it always will be a he, may be in other ways. And yet, as I've said, deeply ingrained in that history is the sense that there is more to this than simply the imposition of ready-made structures. There are qualities of human attention, of specific focus, of willingness to be spoken to by someone else's body, which crucially enshrine the philosophy that I'm trying to explore with you this afternoon. And I think, given the need to break down some of the artificial barriers I've touched on between sciences and humanities. It's particularly important for those professions, those historic professions which lie somewhere on the cusp between sciences and humanities, to bear witness with a helpfully confusing effect to the way in which matter speaks and makes sense. Rather than colluding with that popular mythology which assumes that matter doesn't mean in that way. So we do have a bit of a paradox here, that to be more deeply and intelligently materialistic is actually rather a good thing for us, so long as we know what materiality is. Materialism, which people like myself are supposed to deplore, usually means, in popular language, either the assumption that material and financial advancement is the only thing that matters in our world, or it means that the world basically reduces to a set of easily measurable processes which can be tied up and dealt with efficiently, and ultimately tied up and dealt with by other machines. If I'm right, of course, that really won't do. We need a richer, a more demanding and a more exciting picture of what the material world is. We need to challenge the impoverishment of spirit that teaches us to undervalue matter. I'm trying very hard not to be too theological on this occasion. It's a struggle. But it was one of my predecessors at Canterbury, Archbishop William Temple, who famously observed that Christianity is the most materialistic of the great religions. He didn't, of course, mean by that that Christianity brought you better worldly rewards. There's a fair amount of evidence against that proposition. He did mean that there was built into the Christian worldview, and of course other religious worldviews too, about which he had less to say, a set of very ambitious and surprising assumptions about the material world. That so far from being over against the world of mind and spirit, it is utterly inseparable from it. It is the theatre where meaning is worked out. It is where the most fundamental forms of communication take place. It is, this material world, all we have. And yet, strangely, to say that the material world is all we have, so far from being a depressing and narrowing notion, is, if you have the right sense of materiality, a liberating and enlarging and hopeful proposition. But what it requires from us, all of us, who think about these issues, who practice in various ways this attunement to the body, what it requires of all of us is time and attention. As now a teacher in a higher education institution, I'm very conscious of the way in which alien and baffling metrics are proposed to us so that somebody out there will know that we're doing our job, since we can't be trusted to know that ourselves. And frequently those metrics have something to do with the idea that the transfer of knowledge and information is a neatly measurable matter, with obvious and straightforward consequences, like having better salaries when you graduate. The latest government white paper on higher education infamously suggests that one of the main measures of teaching excellence in higher education institutions should be graduate salaries, in which case, as I've said to many audiences in recent months, my daughter, a primary school teacher in South London, was clearly very badly taught. But it's not only in the world of education that awkward, artificial, and narrowing metrics are around. And I hope that in various quiet but effective ways, other of the historic professions, along with teachers, will be willing to rally to the defense of a world more interesting, more simply alive, than the world sometimes proposed to us as obvious and natural. And that does require a humanizing of the sciences just as much as it requires a scientific apprehension within the humanities. I believe that the most interesting and vital forms of scientific inquiry and practice these days are those which increasingly understand that when we're talking about any of this, we are talking about information, intelligence, interaction. Whatever our beliefs, our ultimate metaphysical beliefs about God and creation, we can at least say that this world of finite interaction in which we live, this world of energy exchange and information exchange, this world which, if you like, at the most superficial level, we can say, yes, is a world of material interaction. We can at least say that this is not a world in which mind is some kind of alien. The world is a world in which intelligence, relation, and exchange are crucial. And to say that is, I think, to say something which many in the medical profession for many, many centuries will have acknowledged and acknowledge today. I don't have a tidy and settled metaphysic to share with you, and what you've been listening to very patiently for the last 40 minutes or so has been effectively a kind of polemic. A polemic against narrowing, reductive pictures of matter and bodies. I've taken it for granted that the way we know is always connected with our bodies. But to say that is at the very same time to understand that we know in far more ways than some reductive models would like to tell us. How we know the state of another person, how we intuit not only the emotion but sometimes the physical condition of another person, how we intuit something of their depth, something of their dimensionality. All of that is deeply part of the intelligent exercise of what we are trained to do. In a society where frequently saving time is prized, where long-term investment of skill and learning is not prized, we have work to do. I hope that an audience like this will be part of that necessary resistance movement into which we're all summoned in a culture more and more at risk in different ways, part of that resistance movement which will speak in favor of what I'm describing as an intelligent materialism, a sense that bodily life is itself fraught with intelligence, and thus requires of us, in our bodily engagement and interaction, the deepest reverence, attentiveness, and, to use that favourite word, attunement. And for your attention, and I hope perhaps here and there, attunement, I'm most grateful.